Thank you very much. Now, first of all, can everybody not hear or hear? You can't hear me? Another microphone. Thank you. People who know me tell me I have a loud voice anyway, so hopefully this will help. Is it okay? Thank you. The first thing I will actually say is I don't want to disappoint anyone, but I'm actually a lab scientist. I'm a bench scientist, and I do most of my work dealing with model system studies, which means most of the data that I'm going to show you today is about model system data. It's not about data that has been collected in humans. But I will mention just very, very briefly at the end of my talk. The second thing that you all should know about me, and I'm embarrassed to say that this at MIT, that I am probably at the low end of the computer use chain. So I might make a mistake with my presentation, so help me out. So going forward is down arrow? Okay. Thanks. During the first Gulf War, there were friendly fire accidents when the U.S. fired on itself, and we injured some of our own soldiers at that time. And we ended up with soldiers that had depleted uranium shrapnel. This is an x-ray of an individual. It shows you one individual. It's a picture of shrapnel pieces that were in an x-ray. It goes to show you what the little pieces of shrapnel would look like. The reason that this is important is because there were some questions regarding depleted uranium and health effects. And I'll expand on this in a minute. But the first thing was most people thought, aha, we know a lot about uranium exposure, so we must know how to handle this particular question. But when the Surgeon General's office asked individuals at AFRI to make a summary of what was known about DU health effects, the answer was, we don't know anything about DU health effects. We know a lot of things about, we think we know a lot of things about uranium exposure, natural uranium, people who work in uranium mines, milling, things like that. But anyway, the question came to our facility was, what can you do for us? Can you do research in this area? And that's where we got started. The questions are very, very important. The first thing that comes to mind is, really, is DU different than other metals that are used? A lot of heavy metals are used in society, so it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that there's actually a lot of research done in the area of heavy metals. Secondly, how does it compare to other toxic heavy metals like nickel, things that are routinely used in our society? And thirdly, what mechanisms might make DU different? What is really different about DU, other than the obvious? I know that earlier you heard a lot about the isotopes. I'm not going to go over it. I just point this out because of the numbers at the bottom. The reason for that is DU's specific activity of 0.43 and natural uranium 0.69 based on the ratio of the different isotopes. I mentioned that because I'm going to show you a study later where I've used different isotopes. I think you know a lot about the fact that DU is primarily emits alpha, does emit some beta and some gamma. Not necessarily that they're not that significant. The alpha is, of course, the heavy hitter. But the other thing about alpha is it will not penetrate even through the sheet of paper. It goes about 56 microns. That's about as far as it'll go. How are we going to study DU? First of all, I told you, human epidemiology is not available. And I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm going to try to be careful not to insult any today. But a lot of the studies that are available on uranium, natural uranium, are not really very good anyway. But we can't use them for DU because, as one thing that I should mention that I didn't see on any of the charts, is in DU, just keep in mind, with DU as opposed to natural uranium, there's no radon exposure. It's not an issue. With uranium miners, people who work with uranium in industry, radon, particularly in the mining, radon is really what is believed to be the problematic issue. That's not the problem with people who might have been exposed to DU either through possible inhalation or ingestion, through wounding, etc. The other thing about metals, they're very tricky, so they're not that easy to study. And the reason for that is there's something called foreign body carcinogenesis. And this means that if you break off a teeny piece of your lead, nice old-fashioned lead pencil and stick it underneath your skin, in most cases, something, a little nodule, will form there. It's benign. It's not going to hurt you. That's solid-state carcinogenesis. It happens with almost every heavy metal. If I pick a big enough piece into an animal, I can get you a tumor. So that's a bit of a problem because that means that when we ever implant heavy metals inside of animals to do our carcinogenesis studies, we will get tumors. But what's that really going to tell us? In the absence of other data, it doesn't mean a lot. It may mean that there's something significant there, but it may not mean a lot. Because I can do it with metals that are used routinely as metal implants for prosthetic devices, like tantalum. Chronic exposure toxicology study was done at AFRI primarily for the purpose of learning about the distribution of uranium from embedded depleted uranium. All of our studies that we do at AFRI do not involve inhalation as an issue. They involve either embedded fragment or embedded pellets in animals, I look in my lab particularly at cellular biological effects. So why are we doing short-term mutagenicity studies, transformation studies, and not the same type of transformation that Dr. Oxenberg talked about earlier? We're really talking about neoplastic transformation, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. What's the benefit of doing it this way? One, I can rapidly compare it to other heavy metals that are widely used in society. We can do a lot of tests very rapidly. Carcinogenesis, neoplastic transformation, genotoxic markers can be looked at, mutagenic markers can be looked at. We can do a lot of rapid screening. Animal studies routinely take over 2 years. We're going to do animal studies. And lastly, the results that are in short-term tests are due to the chemical or radiological aspects of the metal and not due to the physical problem, solid-state carcinogenesis, which is indeed a problem for all heavy metals. Why use short-term tests anyway? Well, because our regulatory agencies in this country require them. Let's say I wanted to develop and market a product, nitrogen hairspray. I have to show that it's not carcinogenic. I have to do it in a couple of ways. They're going to tell me exactly how. The first is you have to use short-term tests. You have to tell them it is not transforming to cells. It is not cytogenetic. It's not a mutagen. Then, if you get that far, you still have to do a 2-year animal study using two separate species, one mouse and one rat, two types of administration, oral and some other way. The animal has to be exposed. So we thought, at the time, I said, I'll even use their plan, basically, which says we can use their required tests in terms of regulatory standards. So these are the approaches. I'm going to talk about transformation first. What is this? This is the hallmark of my laboratory in a lot of ways. We take human osteoblast cells that grow in culture. They're not primary. They're not perfectly, quote, normal. But they're better than just rodent cells growing in culture. So they're a little bit of a step up. But I recognize it's a model system. It's not a human being. They grow in culture. We expose them to something. They morphologically change. So it's actually a qualitative assay in the sense that I look at the colony that's formed. The cell forms a clonal line. I look at the clone and see whether or not its morphology is different. It's then called, quote, transform. Then I further test it. After I have removed it from the dish, I grow it into and I expand it into a full cell line. Then I can inject it in mice to see whether it forms a tumor. And that's the process of neoplastic transformation. The reason we use this is because, in a simple way, quite simplistically, it gives us a transformation frequency. So I can tell you of any agent I test, or chemical or radiation or whatever, what the transformation frequency is in a certain cell model. One thing also we can do with this nice cell model is I can tell you how much radiation was received by the cells in this model. This is called microdosimetry. What we do is we can even change the conditions because we're using DU compounds. We can expose the cells to different times, different amounts, different concentrations. But the one thing that we have to know is how many alpha particles are traversed by how many cells, and that's what we've done here. I've used models where we've used DU, where we've traversed 1%, 7%, or 21% of the cells. And this table, which is a little harder to see, I can't see it unless I step back. Let me see here. Across the top, you're going to see all the comparison of agents that I've done. This is the transformation frequency. A measured per surviving cell times 10 to the minus 4. And I've compared it in three types of situations of DU exposure in vitro to a tantalum. Tantalum is the material used in prosthetic devices. We found a soluble compound. This is a soluble compound of DU. These are insoluble materials. We compared that to our heavy metal tungsten alloy. material, which is a mixture of tungsten, nickel, cobalt, which is also a metal mixture combination that the military uses. The next would be a nickel, an insoluble nickel compound. The reason I use nickel is because it's a great positive control. Nickel is a well-known carcinogen in both, in vitro, in vivo, and in human studies. So we compare it to nickel. And we also compare it to lead chromate, which is also known to be carcinogenic. And then this is alpha particles. The comparison is not to be made in that 100% of the cells were not traversed by alpha in my D situation, but just to show you that alpha particles will cause transformation of these particular cells. But you can't make a one-to-one correlation here. And it's hard to correlate all these numbers in the sense that how much of the cells took up DU in this case compared to tungsten. What we're looking at here, when you look at this column, when you look at this column of 7%, is comparable in terms of toxicity to the tungsten and to the nickel. You can see that the transformation frequency is indeed higher. People routinely will say to me, aha, that means, you know, is that 5 times greater than tungsten? Is it 4 times greater than nickel? It's easy to make that analogy with cell culture, but it's not so easy for me to immediately translate that to another situation. Sorry to disappoint anyone. Believe me, I would like it to be that simple. But nevertheless, it gives us a very good way of comparing the metals. There's no question about that. Next, we're going to tell you about some of the other assays we've done in terms of genotoxicity and mutagenicity. And I'm very quickly going to show you these three things. What we've looked at is whether or not, for our mutagenicity marker, we've looked at HPRT gene. It's a standard assay where you look to see whether or not the gene is mutated in cells. We've looked at a variety of cytogenetic markers, chromosomal damage, where we'll look for things like sister chromatin exchange. We've done Dicentrix. I've done micronuclei, a whole variety. Kind of the textbook of cytogenetic markers have been done, but because of the brevity of time, I'm only showing you one. We've also looked at something known as genomic instability, and I'll explain that further in a moment or two. And I'm going to quickly show you what it looks like on a comparison chart. If you compare the three types of endpoints, mutagenicity, genotoxicity, transformation, and we're looking at DU, nickel, or tungsten, and lead, you can see that there is a that DU frequently does score higher of these particular assays. That indeed, though, it's within a reasonable ballpark. Lead shows itself, as it does in a lot of these assays, to always be, quote, the least effective material. And lead itself, while it's well known for its neurotoxicity, lead is also a weak carcinogen, so it is carcinogenic. Nickel is a strong carcinogen in the dark blue. So that this chart provides a quick comparison of these different assay endpoints comparing these four metals. What about instability? Well, first of all, what I'm saying here is that what the concept actually is, for those who aren't aware, is that you can have an initial cell that is exposed to something, a treatment, whatever, DU, radiation, something else, and that you can monitor that cell, that cell will reproduce, and multiple generations later, you will measure chromosomal damage in cells that were not exposed to the initial exposure. The initial cell obviously didn't die, it went on, didn't appear itself to exhibit any chromosomal damage. But it's many generations later, its offspring did. This is the concept of genomic instability. And what we see here in the fourth group is the instability. I also noticed when it's on this scale, which I should meant to say earlier, is really just number of fold increase above background or spontaneous exposure, spontaneous levels or zero group levels, whatever you want to call it. That in our instability, again, you see DU scores a little bit higher. You have nickel and our tungsten compound similar. Lead comes in a little bit in back, a little behind, so to speak. The questions regarding DU, again, we go back to, well, you know, in all those scores that you would look at, you'd say in all those assays, well, DU always scores a little bit higher. Wonder why. Well, in many cases, that was obviously our question. My question, and the obvious thing that jumps out at people is, oh, it's got some radiation. And amongst ourselves, myself and other very preeminent radiobiologists who deal with physics, Dave Brenner at Columbia, we discuss frequently things like, well, you know, the radiation dose from DU is so low, it's so low, it's so low. I said, yes, but you know, radiation plus chemical effects simultaneously is how it exists. You know, don't you think that, isn't that something that could be responsible? So I really delved into the radiation issue. And that's what the mechanism may be that makes it a little different from these other metals. Mm-hmm. What I did first was an assay where I was able to obtain different, I was able to obtain uranyl nitrate that has different amounts of the isotopes in it. So we could get a uranyl nitrate that was primarily a uranyl nitrate 235. It was considered, quote, pure 235 uranyl nitrate. Also obtained uranyl nitrate with GU and uranyl nitrate with 238. The specific activity differences, obviously, between those two and the 235 were quite significant. But between the two, there's about a 25-30% difference. But the question is, are they going to show up differently in some of these same assays I just showed you? And the question is, yes, they do. When I use these two compounds, looking at the same endpoints, as I told you about before, whether it's a mutagenic endpoint, genotoxic endpoint, or an endpoint looking at transformation, again, the DU compound scored a little bit higher than the 238. And this would indeed suggest that that small amount of radiation does play a role in the effect that we're observing. In of itself, that amount of radiation, that small specific activity that's occurring to those cells, may in themselves not cause any damage, but that's not how it exists. It exists as a compound material that has a radiation and chemical component. Another radiation issue is the bystander effect. This is something that within the radiobiology community is a big question today. What is a bystander? Well, previous radiation biology dogma was that there was the target theory. Radiation hits a single cell, that cell is damaged. Or as many cells as it traverses are damaged. And that makes sense. Cells that are two cells away don't get damaged. Well, apparently in the last 10 years, a lot of data has come out showing that, particularly with alpha particle exposures, that if a single cell, a cell is traversed, but multiple cells exhibited damage. The first thought was perhaps it's instability. The second thought that more and more people found was, what about a bystander effect? Meaning that somehow the injured cell is able to communicate with nearby cells, causing them to have damage. And this is a concept that slowly gained acceptance within the radiobiology community. And so one of the issues was, what about bystanders for DU? What we did here was a lot more difficult, because what the people do at Columbia and other places is they have a microbeam. And what they can do is take 50 cells in a row and irradiate with one alpha particle, one cell number one, cell number five, cell number 10, et cetera, et cetera. They have a microbeam. We don't have one. What we do with DU is we have mixed population studies. We take cells, treat them with DU, then we wash them off, put them next to another petri dish with other cells that do not have DU, and then we look to see whether there is any increased damage. And we've measured increased damage in that new population of cells. We don't see it with nickel, but we see it when we add DU. Again, evidence that radiation is playing a role. So, according to bystander effects, you shouldn't be aware of your neighbor. This is actually for all of radiobiology, this is not just a DU issue. I won't go over the conclusions because I want to quickly tell you about in vivo. And I'm not spending a lot of time on this. AFRI has one other approach that we obviously have a very large in vivo program, and I've chosen to focus on the in vitro today. In our animal studies, we've looked at organ redistribution of uranium, mutagenicity in the urine, using a simple Ames test to the urine, cellular neurotoxicity, genotoxic carcinogenicity. This is an ongoing study. It's not completed at this time. We have some pilot study data. And in most cases, what we find is that there is a dose-dependent response in tissues, meaning that if you see increasing uranium concentration, you do find a lot of effects. You get a mutagenic response in the urine. Animals that were implanted with high numbers of pellets had a high level of mutagenicity as observed in their urine by the Ames test. The human studies I've not been involved with, but I'm just saying very, very briefly, on the soldiers that were injured in the first Gulf War, the urine, the uranium levels are elevated. They've been segregated into different groups based on high and low exposure. I think some genotoxicity reports on lymphocyte studies have been mixed. And most recently, there was studies showing, Dick Albertini was involved in that, he's a leading individual in this country on HPRT, loci in humans, had found that there was a mutagenic response in the lymphocytes of those of some individuals with higher uranium levels. And I believe, I won't have time to tell you about some of our pilot studies other than to quickly say, we do see that with DU pellets in mice, this is a mouse study, this is the big blue transgenic mouse, we see a large number of pellets, we get a fairly high incidence of DU. This is actually primarily tumors in the leg, but we would see the same thing. We find it with nipple too. Again, as I said, nipple's a carcinogen. So we might find a magnitude slightly elevated with DU, sort of in the ballpark with nickel. One thing I mentioned is DU radiation effects in vivo. It's a big question. Most recently, we've done injectable studies. This is not a pellet study. DU, a uranyl nitrate, those two compounds I spoke about, injected in rats over a period of time. We looked at micronuclei and lymphocytes, and we actually are seeing a slight difference between the animals injected with DU versus those that were injected with 238. Seems that there's a slightly higher level of that of the micronuclei. This is a pilot study, so I don't think there is really enough animals yet to make a conclusion, but I think there's a trend here which doesn't suggest in vivo that there are some radiation effects. And I'm not going to read the conclusions. I think you all can look at the data for what it is this time, make some of your own conclusions from that. There's been, over the years, there's been a large number of people that have worked with me on these studies, and I'd like just to acknowledge their assistance and to thank you all for your attention to this very, very rapid talk.
Well, thank you. Fascinating. All right, we're going to move directly to Dr. Tom Fazzi from Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Mount Sinai School of Medicine, probably the preeminent medical institution in the United States in terms of respiratory diseases due to inhalation of things like asbestos and dusts, the home of Dr. Irving Salikoff.
So I'm going to focus my remarks on the toxicology of uranium oxide dusts. And I think kinetic energy penetrators can properly be considered uranium oxide dust disseminators. So let's go back to some very early history of uranium toxicology. Shortly after the exploratory phase, or the year after the exploratory phase, the Manhattan Project began, Vannevar Bush told President Roosevelt that a uranium-235 fission bomb could be built in time to influence the outcome of the war. And at the end of 1942, Enrico Fermi's group announced the first controlled nuclear chain reaction based on uranium-235 fission. In the because of the large number of workers who would be needed to extract and purify and enrich for uranium-235, a large-scale research program in uranium toxicology was undertaken, mostly at the University of Rochester. And before the uranium bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, the broad outlines of uranium toxicology were fairly well established. And I'll just very briefly review those. From the outset, it was clear that respiratory exposures were the most dangerous. And these were experiments carried out in experimental animals, mostly in rabbits, guinea pigs, dogs, rats, and mice. And their sensitivity to the toxic effects of uranium were in that order. Rabbits are most sensitive. Mice are most resistant to the toxic effects of various uranium compounds. But having said that, nonetheless, there are significant potentials for toxic exposures, for example, by the gastrointestinal route, by ingestion. By and large, insoluble uranium compounds are not at all toxic when ingested. You can feed rats 20% of their food by weight of uranium dioxide, which is completely insoluble, for long periods, and they grow normally and are generally healthy. However, soluble, especially soluble, and even slightly soluble uranium compounds are toxic when ingested. And in the context of the depleted uranium, we're talking about principally three oxides. UO2 being the most insoluble and UO3 being slightly soluble. It is possible to cause severe systemic effects in a rabbit by the transdermal route by applying to uninjured skin with the fur removed, by applying suspensions of uranium trioxide. It's possible to cause severe kidney injury. And actually, remarkably, it is possible to kill a rabbit by introducing 100 micrograms of uranium trioxide into one eye. So the rabbits die 5 or 6 days later of renal toxicity. So based on this rather extensive toxicological database, safety procedures were adopted. And just very briefly, we can consider them as protection, isolation, and also monitoring. And so these are widely used in many uranium production facilities. And so, for example, this woman is, although she's working in an airtight glove box, she's wearing eye goggles and protective clothing, and she, you know, has near on her shoulder monitoring the air that she breathes. She has an air monitoring device. However, these safety procedures are not universally observed. In fact, the military uranium weapons industry totally ignores these procedures. And so we could consider two different uranium industries. On the left, we could say the standard uranium industry, those that observe good safety practices, And on the right is the renegade new military uranium industry that ignores safety practices. So generally speaking, the standard uranium industry constantly strives to avoid or to minimize workers' exposure to uranium. And they observe and enforce standard safety protocols, and they abide by good manufacturing practice. On the other hand, the military use of uranium weapons recklessly disperses uranium oxides and dusts, which persist in the environment and which have indiscriminate effects, and which willfully puts soldiers and civilians alike at risk. So the standard uranium industry never intentionally sets uranium metal on fire. But the renegade uranium industry, the combustion of uranium is their reason for existence. So not only is our workers in the standard observant uranium industry well protected and well monitored, but their health outcomes have been well studied. And I would like to emphasize that the health outcomes of individuals exposed to uranium oxide from depleted uranium weapons cannot be predicted on the basis of the health experience of workers who have been well protected and well monitored. And so I would like to just re-emphasize this point since there has been some confusion about it. It's deceptive and fallacious to attempt to predict the health outcomes of unprotected and unmonitored individuals who also are unwitting and unwilling and non-consented. Individuals who are relationally exposed to uranium oxide dust based on the health outcomes of uranium workers who were well monitored and well protected and worked under conditions and protocols specifically designed to minimize or avoid inhalational and other exposure to uranium dusts. So the uranium oxide dusts derived from the combustion of uranium weapons are important environmental health hazards. And first of all, because they are small, many or if not most of these uranium oxide dust particles are respirable. That is, they're smaller than 5 microns. And the uranium content of these uranium oxide dust particles is very, very high, approaching pure uranium oxides. That's in contrast to the natural uranium that's present in sedimentary rocks and in soils, which is naturally present at 2 to 4 parts per million. And so it is not a health hazard mainly for 2 reasons. So 2 to 4 parts per million is very roughly 5 milligrams of uranium per 5 pounds of dry dirt. So there definitely is uranium in your garden, in your natural organic garden. But the vast majority of the uranium-containing particles in soil are large. They're not respirable. Of course, there's a wide spectrum, and a few of them actually are smaller enough to be inhaled, even to the lung parenchyma. But of those few particles that are inhaled, they all have a very, very low uranium content. And the uranium present, there is some uranium oxide, but most of it is present as uranium silicates and uranium carbonates. So the natural uranium normally in the environment is not a health hazard. And so I think this has been sufficiently covered, but the point is that here that there are two important transformations that uranium metal is converted upon combustion into a fine particulate of uranium oxides, much of which is respirable. And the UO3 oxide is slightly soluble, so when that's inhaled, over time it gradually dissolves, gets into the bloodstream, and disperses throughout the body. And as among others, the AFRI group has demonstrated, can enter most tissues, including the brain, the gonads, placenta, and the fetus. The insoluble particles, however, are important because the cells immediately adjacent to them receive a high rate of alpha radiation, and the UO3, when it dissolves into urinal ions, we should keep in mind that urinal ions bind to DNA. They bind in the minor groove of DNA, and therefore their genetic toxicity is not surprising. Okay, I would like to move now to just a very quick review of an epidemiologic study that was organized in the Women and Children's Hospital in Basra, which serves the whole province of Basra. And it was organized approximately in 1995 or 96 by the late Dr. Alim Yacoub and his colleague, Dr. Shanan Hassan, who's a pediatric oncologist. So just to review, in the 1991 war, troops, not only invaded troops in Saudi Arabia, not only coalition troops, not only invaded Kuwait this way, but they also invaded up into Basra, and there was heavy tank battles that were fought in the western and southern part of the Basra province. Since the Women and Children's Hospital was the only hospital where children under the age of 15 with suspected malignancies are sent for diagnosis and treatment, they developed a tumor registry based on the records from this hospital. And so this is another display of the increase in total pediatric malignancies and in leukemias, which constitute 75 or 80% of total pediatric malignancies. So as you can see, there has been, if this is due to the exposure to uranium in the 1991 war, there has been a latency, but recently a very worrisome increase. And this actually shows an interesting feature that not only has there been a quantitative increase, roughly fourfold, in the frequency of childhood leukemia, but there has been a qualitative increase as well. So in 1990, there were two, these are separating cases of leukemia diagnosed under the age of five, between 5 and 9 and above the age of 10. So in 1990, there were two cases of leukemia diagnosed in children under the age of 5. But in 2002, there were 53 cases of leukemia diagnosed under the age of 5. So that is a remarkable and worrisome trend. And that also is concordant with reports of increases of leukemia and breast cancer and lung cancer in the tumor registry in Sarajevo. But let me just move on quickly to a separate study in the same hospital of the incident rates just in that hospital. It's the hospital where approximately 20 or 25% of all births in the Basra government occur. And so there has been an increase in congenital malformations or birth defects, also with a considerable latency, and which shows no sign of abating. So there's the one feature that links the childhood cancers to uranium is that within the 7 districts of the Basra province, the frequency has been highest in those districts where the most uranium weapons were used, and it has been consistently lowest in the city of Basra itself, where uranium weapons, where few if any uranium weapons were expended. Also, I just would like to return to this point to make the point that it is known that in mice, uranium is teratogenic, that it induces birth defects. And as you may recall, mice are the mammalian species most resistant to the toxic effects of uranium. So it doesn't offend reason to consider that uranium oxide exposure may increase the frequency of birth defects in humans. Okay, so I think that I will stop there and hand things over to the chairman.
Thank you. All right, thank both our speakers for two very informative talks. And the floor is open, and Julia is going to handle the microphone.
In the cells, we've looked at a variety of things. We've looked at dicentrics, we've looked at sister chromatid exchanges, we've looked at chromosomal aberrations in terms of chromatids, broken damaged chromatids, and so forth like that. Kind of the classic chromosomal aberration assays. The one thing I would point out about the dicentrics that's very interesting, and this is in the cells, we do find that you do measure dicentrics with something like DU, but you don't measure dicentrics with something like nickel. You don't measure dicentrics with something like the tungsten mixture that we also use. And this is probably because in radiobiology, there's tremendous amounts of evidence suggesting that dicentric is pretty much, with the exception of one or two compounds, a radiation-specific chromosomal damage that can be measured. Although, you know, there are those couple of studies that show that perhaps with bleomycin you can see it. But nevertheless, I didn't show it as evidence that there is cellular damage due to, quote, radiation, alpha radiation. But we believe that dicentrics also support that, too. I wouldn't say that, we haven't done any comparison studies yet between saying trying to monitor, measure very, very, as you know, micro dosimetry is not that simple a thing to do. And I'm not the expert in that at all. I've worked with Dudley Goodhead at the MRC on that, and also John Hum, of course, at Sloan Kettering in New York. And what we've tried to do, though, is to mimic the dose that we believe we've received to ourselves in the cultures, and then look at that dose specifically and to actually replicate that dose with an alpha exposure only. So we're in the process of doing that, so we might be able to answer that question shortly about Dicentrix and DU and so forth.
Thank you.
So I would like to ask a question of Alexandra. So in your presentation, you covered a great deal of data, and you briefly mentioned that you tested implanted depleted uranium in these transgenic big blue mice.
Right.
So did you see increased mutant, I thought you just spoke of tumors, did you see increased mutant frequency in any tissues?
Well, I probably shouldn't show it because it's not a finished study, but yes, we do. In the time points we've looked at, and that is up to 6 months. So, yes, 6 months. Well, we've only evaluated several of that. We looked at the kidney, we looked at the muscle, immediately adjacent to where the pellets were implanted, and the kidney and the liver. The mutant frequency in the liver is not particularly high. It is in the kidney, and it is in the muscle adjacent to where the pellet is implanted. And when I say particularly high, I'm saying in comparison to tantalum implanted. In all of our animal studies, we have a control group, which is a tantalum implanted control group. The pellet of tantalum is the same size. It is actually made somewhat differently than the DU. We purchased the DU little pellets from Oak Ridge National Labs, and they're very, very tiny. They look like extremely small, good and plenty, for lack of a better description. They're about 1 by 2, some sort of cylindrical, and they're implanted. They don't seem to cause, just for those who are concerned about some of the animal issues also, I'd like to mention this, they don't seem to, when they're implanted, they're not implanted in a way that seems to affect the behavior of the animal or any of that sort of thing. But in terms of the big blue, because they are mice, they're a little bit smaller, you do have to carefully implant them a little differently than you would in a larger rat model.
There are big blue rats.
Yes, these are mice. These are big blue mice. Yes, we're considering a big blue rat study.
And have you planned to test bone marrow or donuts?
Yes, we do. Hasn't been done yet.
Thank you.
Yes.
We did a study done on the veterans about the effect of the uranium exposure. I would think that in a country like the United States, there would be so many more opportunities to conduct the study of the resource we had.
Well, I'm not the best one here to respond to that.
That's going to be discussed in the policy.
All right. So we'll come back to the question of monitoring veterans in the third panel. In the rear.
I have a question for Dr. Faizi, which is given that you're placing some emphasis on uranium oxide dust, which are probably going to be more prevalent in the early phases of after an attack. Why? How do you explain the epidemiological data, which shows like much higher rates later on?
Yeah. So one way to interpret that is with respect to leukemia. This has been a hot point in recent years in leukemia research, and that is the occurrence of leukemia in identical twins. So if monozygotic twins who had a monochorionic placenta, they shared a blood supply in intrauterine life. So if one twin gets leukemia before the age of 4 or 5, it's almost inevitable that the other twin will eventually develop leukemia. And therefore, it's widely assumed that the first genetic lesion in a child who is diagnosed with leukemia at age 4, that actually the first genetic lesion occurred in utero or in possibly in one or the other of the parents. And so you know, that's one possible explanation for the latency. And actually, Iraqi physicians believe there's a very strong correlation with the children with malignancies and also with severe birth defects, that their father was a soldier in the 1991 war and therefore had an exposure. But if he inhaled uranium oxide dust, it would take some time for UO3 to dissolve, to re-equilibrate around his body and to accumulate, let's say, in the testes. And so that you know, is one possible explanation for the latency. The increased frequency of tumors in the Sarajevo tumor registry was earlier than that, but that was mainly looking at adults.
I think it's worth reminding people that cancer is a disease as you get older with a very long lag time, normally of adults. I mean, to get these kind of increases in young children is extremely dramatic. When such things are found in the United States, it's an immediate crisis, immediate public health crisis, as in Woburn, the childhood leukemia cases in here in Woburn. Yes.
It concerns this request about the children. Again, I think you have explained it, but you're sure that the number of children with age lower than 5 increased more than the other groups, right?
Well, with respect to the age distribution of the children with leukemia dramatically shifted.
Yeah.
So that there was a slow increase in leukemia diagnosed in children between 5 and 9 and between 10 and 14 or 15. But there was a dramatic increase in leukemia in younger children.
What year were they exposed? I mean, if you take children younger than 5 years, I mean, they were exposed after the war, right?
No, so you're assuming, like, as which is a reasonable assumption, that it's the child that's exposed. But as I was trying to point out before, people in leukemia research increasingly believe that when a child presents with leukemia at age 3, 4, 5, that the first genetic lesions actually occurred in utero. And you know, there's a policy in many countries to for various genetic studies to take every newborn child's blood and to spot it on a piece of paper. They call those Guthrie cards. And so there have been studies when you take a large number of Guthrie cards and do molecular genetic analyses, you can see that a small number of children do have some of these characteristic chromosomal translocations or lesions associated with leukemia. But those children never go all the way to accumulate the subsequent genetic lesions that are required for clinical leukemia. I think people in leukemia research increasingly believe that for young children, the very first genetic lesion occurs in utero and possibly in one of the parents.
Can I add something quickly to that?
Yes.
Yuri Dubrova at the University of Leicester in the UK is working not on DU at all, but he works with Chernobyl patients who were either exposed to Chernobyl or who themselves were teenagers and went on to have children themselves, and they have increased leukemia rates. And what Dubrova's group, I believe, has recently shown, I'm not sure whether it's just in press or published yet, that there are many satellite mutations in the bone marrow of some of these children, and they are very young, and they weren't even there at Chernobyl. Their parents were living in the area, maybe near each other. I'm not sure of that, but nevertheless, there is definitely evidence to that today about issues with leukemia.
And again, I point out that's not really a DU issue, at least from a Duroba study at all, but it is interesting from a radiation study to see the offspring with that.
Yes.
You know, I noticed that one of the things that's absent from this discussion is any of the people from, for instance, from Vieques, who have done the impact studies on the effects of DU on the population there, whom the U.S. military has been pounding with DU for years. I would have liked to have seen more people who are working on the ground in Iraq with the people that are having the abnormal birth defects and the cancers. And I find it really, really upsetting to have a panel that's primarily taken up by the war criminals from the U.S. military that are sitting there talking about whether depleted uranium affects a rabbit or a rat. How about the people that are on the ground receiving your constant bombing?
Well, let me say, we certainly agree that the were it possible to have here the people who are on the ground in Iraq, that they would add a dimension. I don't know how one would do it at this particular time in U.S. history. The point about Vieques is well taken, because in fact there are people in Boston, and we will take that under serious consideration. Second round of this subject, maybe next fall, we'll let in the Puerto Rican experience.
Yes, the question I have is with respect to the UN study that we've done so far. The data and the investigations, of course, are in their infancy at this point. And yet, reflecting a bit some of the passion and anger from the previous questioners, concerns. We do have people who are, shall we say so, wedded to the military effectiveness of DU weapons that certainly have an interest in there not being data coming out that would call into question, let's say, what they consider the safety of use of these weapons. My question for Tom is, even though we don't have that much information, you say that the studies stand up methodologically to what we'd like to see coming out of medical centers and research teams in terms of, you know, confounders, selection bias, etc. How do they stack up? Are they impervious to criticism at this point?
Well, in any kind of an environmental study, you would like to have exposure data and dosimetry and to see if there are dose effects and effect relationships. And that it hasn't been possible to do that yet. Although, as I pointed out, there was a geographical correspondence with the areas most heavily affected by the use of uranium weapons in the 91 war and subsequent increases in childhood cancer. So obviously, these are the kind of studies that can't be designed in advance, and controls of that type. But in most of these studies, the control is before. The presumed exposure, and then the health changes and health outcome subsequently.
Well, they're preliminary, but are they telling us something?
I think they're very worrisome. And there's, may I just try to jump ahead to these are data from the Sarajevo Tumor Registry, which show worrisome increases in breast cancer, lung cancer, and leukemia plus lymphoma. And I think that I also have a very recent a figure from a very recent paper last month of the increased frequency in congenital heart disease reported from the pediatric hospital in Kuwait that treats all children with pediatric with congenital heart disease. So there, and interestingly, there isn't very much of a latency after 1991 related to the congenital heart disease increase in Kuwait.
I want to make sure that some of the hottest, most difficult, and livest questions around here are going to be addressed in the third panel on the policy, and we want to make sure that this time for the discussion of those presentations. So if nobody objects, I would call it adjourn this panel, take a five-minute break. There's still, are the cookies still out there? There's still cookie, coffee, and juice out there. And then please return. Let's give our two panelists